so much. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Eric, for this exceptionally kind introduction. Very, very wonderful. So I would like to talk with you today about Of Rice and Men, the Jamming of Particles and Peoples. I wish I could claim to you that John Steinbeck penned these words. I would hug him and pet him and squeeze him and name him George. But actually, no, this is a meme of our culture, and Tex Avery and Chuck Jones and others have appropriated it for Bugs Bunny cartoons and the like. Nevertheless, it was too appealing to miss being able to use that kind of play on words to introduce what I'm going to talk about. What does it mean for a system to be jammed? Well, there are two words there that I need to define more carefully. First of all, system. We are not all physicists here, so my understanding of system, I need to convey that. When a statistical physicist says I'm talking about a system, we're talking about a large number of interacting entities. Sand, grain, bubbles, oil droplets, and water. If you work for Exxon, they care about that a lot. Red blood cells, DNA molecules, maybe cars on a road, maybe people at a rock concert. Statistical physicists have made great contributions in the last couple of decades by venturing into fields that seem like maybe they're economics or maybe they're sociology and applying their methods. So we have vehicles, we have bubbles, we have corn, and all of these as an aggregate constitute systems. Now, what do I mean by saying a system is jammed? Well, to a materials physicist, jammed would mean that the system develops a yield stress in a disordered state. Yikes, yield stress, what's that? Well, it's like a solid in that it can withstand forces. You compress it, it pushes back. You shear it, it pulls back. That would be a system that has a yield stress, and it doesn't fall apart, and it doesn't flow like a liquid. However, it does not have the regular structure of a crystal. Here's a salt crystal, sodium and chloride in a very nice, close-packed, orderly configuration. Here is Gillette foamy. Gillette foamy, when you look really close, it's got these bubbles, these soapy bubbles. It's soap and water and some kinds of oily moisturizing things that give you that smooth skin that helps them market the product. And so definitely not an orderly system. But I would argue it's a solid. It doesn't flow like a liquid. You push it and there's a dimple in it and the dimple stays there. Another example of this kind of rigidity allows wet sand to be walked on without collapsing and displaced and still retain its new shape. And there are these remarkable sand paintings created with a rake by artist Andres Amador with lots and lots of helpers who'd create fantastical shapes on the shore in San Francisco. And then gradually the ocean comes and takes them over. It's really beautiful. And it is due to the jammed state of wet sand. So I have one demonstration. I am a theorist. So you never know, front row people, you're very brave to be there in the front row of a demonstration. So what I've got is wet sand and some rope, and I'm going to put the rope in the glass, and I'm going to pour the wet sand in the glass, and I'm going to pull on the rope, and it pulls right out of the sand. Okay, makes sense, makes total sense. Try. Oh, I'm sorry. Show what? Oh, sure. Yeah. On top of it. Well, I don't want to get sand on the nice computer, but I'll try and do this a la carte or off the cart. Okay. Boop. Okay. Is that good? All right. So that was so great. Let's do that again. Now, I really do need this, but I'm going to put this rope in this glass again, and I'm just pour wet sand on it again. But now I'm going to say the magic words, a la peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Oh, my God, it didn't work. I told you I was a theorist. All right, we'll try it once more, one more time. See if it works. I'm a little worried about banging on that. I need something really solid to bang on. It worked in rehearsal. It really did. It really did. All right. It does work. LG has seen it work. So what was supposed to happen is that when I bang the sand very forcefully, the sand compresses, and the cup is actually levitated. There we go. So marginal. All right, so what we have done is turn something in a flowing, liquidy state to something in a solid state, solid enough to be able to hold its own weight with the rope. Oh, my goodness, okay. It's all downhill from here. Good. So what does it mean for a system to be jammed? I just mentioned what it means for inert matter, but for entities that are not inert, that are mice, for example, rather than rice, or as Helbing would call entities like mice, particles with a will. A will to eat cheese. It's most appropriate to think of jamming, and most humane, not as what happens when you squish them, but rather when they're in a state of arrested motion. And so if you have so many mice, or actually PETA thinks these are rats, they look like juvenile rats to me, or mice. If you have so many of them that they are jammed, in order to understand that, you really need to understand biology, physiology, psychology, and cognitive science, and people would argue you also need to understand physics. Shad Schneider, the physicist, says a crowd can be treated like a many-particle system, and ideas from statistical physics can be used to model the collective effects without having to know physiological or psychological features. So let's see if that holds water. What might we ask about a crowd of people? We might ask about motion. So I want to spend a little time talking about motion. 1937 might be the year of the first publication like this from the Institute of Architecture of the Russian Academy of Arts. Is that a good place, Bob and Laurie, Russian Academy?
Not mine.
So these people who are queuing in Germany, which is, you know, are part of an experiment that's meant to elucidate what these Russians wrote about the fundamental diagram. So the fundamental diagram expresses how fast the people are moving as a function of the density of people. And what you can see is that the more densely people are packed, the more slowly, on average, they will move. And that makes good sense. And it's true whether people are moving in a line or whether they're moving in a broad open space. Also, whether the flow is unidirectional or whether people are trying to go in opposite directions, who is walking. These are other things you might ask about, and you might ask if they modify the fundamental diagram. In a detailed sense, yes, but in a broad sense, no. So a statistician might want to know, well, V is the average speed, but what's the distribution of speeds like? You might want to know, what is the effect of obstacles? So I'll just show a few of these. Bidirectional flow, Seyfried in 2012 showed this remarkable result that whether people were unidirectional in blue or whether he had streams of people trying to go in opposite directions, the flow diagram is very little changed. Yeah, they are going a little bit slower at higher densities, but it's remarkable how similar these are. And why should that be the case? Well, it's an emergent behavior called lane formation. So let's see if we can get PowerPoint to show a movie. Okay. So here is an experiment with people going in opposite directions. And you can see that these particle people very readily create a channel for themselves spontaneously. This happens spontaneously with no leadership. It just happens. And so given that we see this sort of emergent phenomenon of lane formation, it makes good sense that you might not see much difference whether people are moving in one direction or whether they're two groups of people each trying to get to opposite points. Another interesting fact has to do with the correlation between the overall goodness of life in a country and the rate at which people walk. And now this table that I took has to do with the free speed. So people walking alone, in general, how fast do they walk? This is something called a normalized Z-score. And Switzerland up here with a high negative number is a country with a high gross domestic product and so on. And so these authors, Levine and all, looked at how fast people would walk. They also looked at how fast a letter would get across the country. And they also looked at whether the clocks were keeping proper time. And I guess we have Eric to thank for the fact that we score high there. And clock accuracy, not so much, but the rate at which a letter travels and walking speed was actually meaningfully correlated with the general kind of economic and social wellness of the company. So Switzerland did very, very well with walking speed, as did Ireland. And down here, Indonesia, not so good. And Mexico, definitely don't mail a letter in Mexico. And the walking speed. Yes, they walk faster in countries where there is better wellness by many metrics that economists, you know, would accept. Okay, motion of pedestrians. I put these two quotes before you because I think they provide an interesting point and counterpoint. Both of them refer to this study in 2009. Here are Indian folks. Here are German folks. You've seen them before, walking speeds of Germans and Indians. Low density is about the same. Now, you just saw a figure that showed they were slightly different, but they're very different at higher densities. And the way The Economist, which I believe is a British publication, spins it is they say, as you probably read because you all giggled, this won't be news to anyone familiar with Munich and Mumbai, but Indians are just less bothered about bumping into people. So, I don't know, I find this a bit of a disturbing phrase. First of all, it's not been proven that anyone is bumping into anyone. Secondly, no one is asking whether anyone is bothered about this behavior. And as a counterpoint, I really like the fact that Chatterjee, in the paper that was written, said, surprisingly, the unordered behavior of Indians is more effective than the ordered behavior of the Germans. So let us realize that the Indians get where they're going faster than the Germans do, and that can have quite a positive kind of light cast upon it, not a negative one. As far as what age has to do with walking, here's a figure that shows not only that older people in general in Germany walk more slowly than the typical commuter of a younger age. So here 50% of people who are over age 65 are moving a little over 60 meters a minute, but 50% of the heterogeneous population, which tends to be younger, are moving at 80 meters a minute. So that's one lesson from this slide. Another lesson is that if you know how to take the derivative of this integral, which is the cumulative distribution, you would say, oh, Gaussian, the distribution of walking speeds is like a normal curve. It's Gaussian. And its mean is around, well, I have a slide, around 1.3 meters per second. So this fundamental diagram due to Weidman gets quoted a lot. Weidman did scanned 25 publications, so I guess we would call that meta research. 25 publications, sometimes people were walking in the same direction, sometimes opposing, sometimes narrow sidewalks, sometimes in open space, different places, and derived this curve that has a parametric form. It's some equation that's got it's a simple exponent. It uses an exponential. Anyway, it's a smooth curve with only a couple of parameters, and it describes this fundamental diagram. How fast are you walking as a function of how dense the people are around you? And here's a little bit of data that shows how things fall on the curve from 1969. It turns out that this data set comes from a women's college, and this data set comes from a co-ed college. And so we can say, wow, it's a little different at the women's college. They are walking more slowly and more densely on their sidewalks in their campus. Yet, certainly all these data do fall on the curve. Now, there are two points I want to highlight on this curve, and one of them is this free walking speed, which it is claimed is around 1.3 meters a second, with a big standard deviation, around a third of a meter a second. And the other leads me into the main part of my talk, which is the jamming density. So at some density, which is claimed is sort of 5.5 people per meters, people per meter squared, motion stops. And I find that to be a little bit remarkable. It stops. Why does it stop? Why can't people all kind of move forward lockstep? Well, people just won't move forward lockstep. In fact, as Raman says, as the pedestrian traffic density increases, the movement of faster pedestrians is likely to be impeded by slower pedestrians. So eventually, this dispersion kind of makes people shuffle. And at the jamming density, actually, you would say there's really no motion altogether. And this density is not the same density for all the peoples of the world. Here again, we have to admit, in India, the fact that the jamming density varies with minimum personal space, and the less personal space you're comfortable with having, the higher the jamming density is going to be. An Indian crowd can move forward in general when a German crowd is all jammed together going, was ist los, you know. Yeah. So I hope I don't have to convince you that modeling of jamming is a really important social project. It not only helps day-to-day problems of people moving around in public spaces, but it also impacts extraordinary problems, as when there is an emergency, there needs to be an evacuation, there's a crowd. Understanding motion near repulsive and attractive objects is important, so this slide is meant to address that issue. There have been many difficulties, for example, during the Islamic Hajj, the traditional pilgrimage. Particularly dangerous is access during the stoning of the devil ritual. So there are these monuments, the Jamarat, or Jamarat, I'm sorry, I don't speak Arabic, but the Jamarat monuments, there are three monuments, they represent demonic presences, and the idea is then one must approach them in a particular order, stone them in a particular way, and then step back and let others come through. And that's particularly difficult because there's kind of this circle around the monument, and so there's a radial flow of people inward, and then they need to come out again. And there's also this transverse flow of people. And there have been a lot of injuries, and groups of scientists, in particular Al-Ghadi et al., have been very successful at writing a set of equations that model this behavior, and it's actually called the Jamarat model of pedestrian flow in this situation. So here you see pilgrims on the way to the Jamarat. Another situation that's really serious is understanding motion of large people near doorways and passageways. I took this from the web. It's a recent shot of Liverpool fans who are, in a way, celebrating the fact that the British Prime Minister finally acknowledged, decades after a terrible tragedy in which 96 people were killed at a Liverpool soccer game, that it wasn't hooliganism, that it wasn't alcoholism, that no one was behaving in an inappropriate way so that 96 people were crushed to death, but rather it was crowd dynamics and it was physics, and there was a little bit of blame put on the police because the police didn't act quickly enough to evacuate people who were hurt seriously but could have been saved if they'd received prompt medical attention. And what happened was a gate that had normally been closed or had been closed in two previous seasons was left open, and it led to a narrow passageway, and that passageway led to a holding area with a lot of fans that was already full, and no one knew what was ahead, and many of the fans were crushed against a concrete barrier, and some to escape were like climbing onto the field. It was a horrible situation. And in response to situations like that, there have been some wonderful projects. The German Federal Ministry of Education has funded the Hermes Project, which is this fabulous tour de force where applied mathematicians, computer scientists got together and created a system with cameras, with image recognition, with software that will project about 15 minutes into the future for a venue, and will say, given that all these people are where they are right now, in 15 minutes I would expect them to be here, and can alert the staff to, okay, we need to make these modifications, doors, gates, this and that. So the Hermes Project sounds like a wonderful innovation. There's also a private company called, it has a pedestrian dynamic simulation in control. It's the In Control company. So if you're the manager of a large venue, you can actually buy commercial software that's going to map out your venue, that's going to map out your seating, that's going to take account of who is going where, when, and do the same kind of predictive magic for you to be able to help you ensure the safety of the people who are at your venue. So that's stuff about people and jamming. And now I'd like to switch gears and talk about physical applications. So if you're not an animal in a crowding situation, jamming is actually quite a cool subject. Jamming is a phase transition. And so here what we've got is a phase diagram. For those of you who don't do a lot of thermal physics, what a phase diagram consists of is some axes that represent control parameters, like how dense is the system here, what temperature is the system here, are you stressing it from the outside or not. And on the inside here, when the temperature is low, when the stress is low, when the density is quite high, this is 1/density, so down here we have a jammed phase. And then let's just say we move along the density axis. At a certain critical density, so out here, 1 over density is getting large, so density is getting small. This is a very special point that Liu and Nagel have proven is a point of phase transition, like water to steam, like water to ice, and it's called point J. So this is exciting to people who care about statistical physics. It's also kind of exciting to people who watch Indiana Jones movies. LG and I were just watching Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull the other night, and Indy and Marianne, they were like sinking in this thing. It wasn't quicksand. He said, it's not quicksand, it's something. I don't know, it was quicksand. So they were sinking in this stuff, and he said, don't struggle, you'll sink faster. Well, what do you do if you struggle? If you struggle, you stress it. You stress the material around you. If you stress the material around you, and the material happens to be jammed, and you come out here, oops, unjammed liquid, down you go. So it made total sense. Right? As much as an Indiana Jones movie can make sense. All right, so jamming is cool. Here's a little cartoon from a Siemens and Van Heck introduction, and you can see these featureless blobs. They are the members of our system at low density. They're unjammed, then at a critical density, they jam up, and then at a higher density, they're still jammed. And you can ask about interesting things like the pressure. Here there is no pressure provided by these guys. And then at the critical density, so this is the excursion from the critical density. Below zero, we're below it. Above zero, we're above it. Really, a phi means volume fraction. So it's actually not just, it's not the density being technically correct. This is the volume of the white space that is taken up by the red guys. Okay. So at the critical volume fraction, pressure starts to rise, and in fact it rises linearly, and that's something that folks are excited about, that it's a universal thing that the pressure rises linearly, independent of many other features of the model. Another important thing, I don't know if you would, you know, think of this firsthand as being important, I adore it, this is the contact number, it's the number of neighbors. So immediately below the jamming threshold, why should any particle be touching another particle? At zero temperature, it just isn't, it's just phenomenally unlikely. Suddenly at jamming, the contact number rises to a certain value. It's jammed up. Everybody needs enough neighbors to be stuck in their place, to be static. And not only is that a point of staticness, it's a point of isostaticness. So James Clerk Maxwell, who most of us think of as one of the founders of electromagnetism, actually was the first person to talk about isostaticity and to say, you know, if the number of degrees of freedom, that is the ways that any particle can move, is exactly equal to the number of physical constraints, the things holding that particle in place, it is perfectly rigid, and isostatic means not too many constraints and not too few constraints. And here's my little illustrative slide or quiz. Okay, one of these shapes is isostatic and one is not. If you built it out of wood and you put nails there, which one of these is isostatic? And which one is not? What do you think? Talk among yourselves. Talk to the person next to you. Decide. This is what we do in Physics 3. What do you think? I don't know. They both look pretty solid. Okay, time. People who think it's A signify by saying I, or A.
I.
Great. People who think it's B.
I.
Oh, thanks, Elchie. Okay. Actually, truly, it is A, because truly B can be nudged and turned into a parallelogram, and it's not stable, and you have to nail a cross brace onto it, and there you go. And then you got two triangles, and it's isostatic. Okay. I don't build many things. It took me a while to get okay with this, but I'm okay with this now. All right, so I had to work rice in somewhere because I called this a rice man. So here comes the rice. But not men. Let's talk about gumballs. You wouldn't believe how hard it is to find a naturally occurring grain that's spherical. Quinoa, sort of, not really. Does anybody know a grain that's spherical? I couldn't. Couscous. I looked at couscous. It's a little pudgy. Yeah. When it's cooked, it's spherical. When it's dry, you're right, Lori. When it's before you cook it, it's got a little bit of an anisotropy to it. Yeah. So isostaticity is actually the exception, not the rule. If you have a very stumpy grain of rice, well, you have a paradox, because if it were exactly spherical, James Clerk Maxwell would tell me I need 6 contacts to have isostaticity. But if it's elongated, it's like this, it can wiggle. It's not just x-axis, y-axis, z-axis. It's also, oh, I can wiggle like this. So you actually need more constraints to keep this thing from wiggling. Well, all right, you actually, if this were like rice, it would need 10. So is it, what if you have a really stumpy thing that's only slightly, and the answer is in the data. A spherical particle at jamming has 6 contacts. As soon as it gets to be slightly elongated, it zooms up to have the right number 10 to be isostatic. But in the middle, it's not isostatic, it's actually hypostatic. You can get jammed systems of spheroids that still have freedom, but they're still jammed. They still have a bulk modulus and a shear modulus. So there was my nod to the rice. And what I'd like to do to motivate the fact that we've been studying jamming with the idea that we're trying to enhance jamming, I'd like to tell you that sometimes jamming is desirable, not with human beings in a public space, but for example with these things called soft jamming robots. So rather than an articulated robotic hand or an articulated robotic claw, we think of something that's for all the world like a balloon that's filled with coffee grounds. In fact, the first prototype did have coffee grounds in it, smelled really good. And what you do is you have a kind of a system here. I'm not sure if we should call it hydraulics. It's not a fluid, it's air. And air is sucked out of the balloon and the balloon becomes hard and jammed. And anyone who's ever bought coffee as vacuum packed knows you buy these bricks of coffee in the supermarket, and then if you open it up and put a spoon in it, it's all flowy, it's not hard. Well, you've just seen a jamming to unjamming transition. So suck the air out of it, it becomes rigid and hard, and then poof the air back into it, it becomes soft, and it's amazing at picking stuff up. And in the still picture I have here, it's also amazing at playing darts. It's the thing you want to take to the pub. So let's see if we can get the movie to play. It seems to take me 2 clicks to make movies to play. So this is a Cornell-Chicago collaboration. I'm going to have all the movies playing at once because it's a little dull to just have one. So let's see them all. Oh, the middle one's going to show
soft,
you.
A soft mobile morphing robot is a desirable
things.
Platform
oh, this
for traversing
one is,
complex
oh, yeah,
terrain
yeah, yeah.
and navigating small holes.
Turn down the sound. I'm going to move this one forward, show you the robot kind of oozing around. Here we have the robot shooting baskets. Here we have the robotic gripper. Oh, there it's moving about. So why? How is it moving? It's because different chambers are inflated with air at different moments in synchrony to actually make it locomote. That's very, very, very clever. They also have them that can collapse, ooze through a little crack, and then puff up again. It's pretty terrific. And so in this one, we've got that brick for just being really good at picking up. It can pick up an egg that's uncooked. You can pick up a pin, a dime. Much improved from anything that's made of mechanical metal, and here it's just having fun kind of shooting springs and bolts into different boxes. So, isn't that cool? Love those jamming robots. So, maybe in a few years we'll have the Swarthmore jamming robotic team, I don't know. Our robotics team is pretty awesome already. So let me say a little bit about simulation. How should we simulate? Well, what do we care about? Do we care about statics or dynamics? What do I mean by that? I mean, static properties might be, well, at what density does the system jam up? What are the forces like? Here is a very popular exhibit at a science museum. It's got these little plastic discs lit in just such a way that when a child comes up and moves a piece of metal to stress the system in a particular way, the lines of large force, the stress lines, show up as a bright spiderwork web of lines. And in fact, here, like, there's a nice simulation by Rajdai and Rue in 2008 where they simulated disks and got these spidery lines. Looks similar. In fact, statistically, the distribution of forces is uncannily similar from the simulation to the real-world application. So you might be concerned with how the force lines are distributed in the system. How many near neighbors? That speaks to isostaticity. Is it a really filamentary system with just the right number of near neighbors? Or is it very packed in, overly constrained? And the role of obstacles or attractions. And so this is the one that I want to show you just a couple of results about. I'm sensitive to the fact that this is not a technical audience, so I will try to warn you that something technical is coming and let you know it's a good time to check your cell phone for messages. So One project that we've had some success on has been the jamming, the simulation of jamming around fixed particles. We're in a collaboration with Professor Andrea Liu at Penn and her remarkable grad student Carl Goodrich has been really the big mover and shaker on this project at Penn. And we've had several Swarthmore students on the project. Sam Amandine Elliott, who's now at Cornell, and Samer. Are you here, Samer? Hi, Samer. Samer is hard at work at this stuff right now. He knows more about it than I, because he checked the cluster at Penn this morning, maybe. So he knows more about our data than I do at this moment. So we're very lucky to have Samer, and lucky to have these other students as well. Okay, jamming around fixed particles, what am I talking about? Well, a lot is known about what happens when you take an empty system and you fill it with particles and then, you know, jams up at a certain density. Surprisingly, not much is known about what happens if you first have that system filled with these landmarks. Maybe it's a two-dimensional system and you've etched pillars in. Maybe it's a three-dimensional system and you've got some kind of webbing in there and then you're introducing the moieties that are about to jam. And so these are the kind of two-dimensional lattices we've been playing with. These are actually oversized. Our ideal is to have just points that are infinitely strong but infinitesimal in size to hold the jamming system there. So we've got them in a hexagonal lattice, a square lattice, thrown at random. And this is something quenched disorder. I would not have thought of it, but it turns out this is really important in the superconductivity community. It has to do with pinning of vortices. It's also interesting in the glass community. So we did these as well, and what I mean by it, this picture is, these are disks of the type that I'm going to put in and let find their place, but we throw a bunch of them in at first and glue them down, and they can't. They have no mobility. Physicists tend to love simple models. There's this joke about a cow, the problem having to do with a cow needing to get its water from a feeder and getting, it's actually true, I hear. You know, it needed to drink some water, and every time it came up to the feeder because it was, or the water feed, because it was metal, it actually got a shock. And so they brought in a physicist to try and figure out how the cow would not be shocked. And he came back in that era, all physicists were he, with the report, and the first line was, assume a spherical cow. So we physicists love to assume spherical cows. There they are in the field, not grazing, but in the field. So here are our spherical cows. There's disks in 2D, there's spheres in 3D. They can overlap, they're soft, but when they overlap, it costs energy. Or another way to think about it is they exert forces on each other. And the more overlap, the more force. So they want to stay apart. We simulated zero temperature. We're not going to shear the system in what I'm going to show you today. There's not going to be any friction. And here's our protocol for the CS folks in the audience. If you care, the codes happen to be in this language, C++. So we first position our fixed particles. Then we throw in our mobile particles, N of them, at random positions. Then we equilibrate the system to find the lowest energy configuration. So this would correspond to us working at zero temperature. The algorithm, if anyone cares about one algorithm, is called the fire algorithm. And we also use a modified Newton's method. It seems to work. We seem to find an energy minimum. Do we find the energy minimum? That's too hard a question to answer. And then we remove Rattler. So let me go back and forth between two slides and see if you see any difference. Look right here. Right? So boom, 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 boom. Are folks seeing that? Okay, cool. So about 3% of the particles are not going to have any neighbors. If you shook the system, they would go rattle, rattle, rattle. If you turned it upside down after gluing the others, they'd fall out. So we do remove the rattlers. They're not part of the mechanical stability of the system. Here's one result. I'll throw three results at you. One result answers the question, how does the jamming threshold change with the number of fixed particles? And the answer seems to be, this is a square lattice of these point-like particles. The threshold drops linearly with the fraction of heads, and that's really good. We've gotten a reduction of the jamming threshold by putting in zero volume fraction of things in here. Now, an interesting thing happens. In a jammed system, either nothing is stuck or everything is stuck if there are no pegs there. But if you have maybe I'll skip two slides forward. Once you put in these obstacles, you have the situation where yellow is rattlers, a lot of rattlers, some particles here, the light green ones that are stuck, the dark green ones are actually fixed particles, but they don't span the system. So you have this existential question, shall I call this jammed or shall I not call it jammed? And it really has no fundamental answer, but I think the practical answer is this isn't a jammed system. This isn't what we want to talk about when we say, oh, it's a solid, I can squish it and it'll push back at me. This won't if you squish it this way. So we want to throw out finite clusters and only keep the infinite clusters. Here's a system that's jammed, and how do we know? Well, Elliot Padgett, 13, wrote a wonderful algorithm that traces along all of the particles that are not rattlers and says, have I actually got a spanning cluster? If people who know the lingo percolation, it was a percolation algorithm. So he saw, did things percolate? And this allowed us to go to much larger numbers pinned, in fact, infinite numbers pinned, you know, because now we don't have this ambiguity. So really happy that we have that capability in the code now. Here's our second result. What lattice geometry supports a jammed structure most readily? Interestingly, we actually got an answer that there was one in two dimensions. A hex-fixed lattice with exactly the same density of particles supports the jammed structure measurably better than a square lattice does, and measurably better than the random lattice. And this is this really interesting question that speaks to how do I build something and make it jam more easily, with less stuff in it, more quickly. And clearly, three-dimensional calculations are important to do, and we have a routine that does three dimensions. We have certain things that Samer could tell you about before we get this going on this project. But certainly, by next summer, we'll be able to answer this question for three-dimensional lattices as well. And there's more choice. I've been told by a wonderful applied mathematician that whatever question you ask in two-dimension, the answer is the hex lattice. But in three-dimension, there are lots of wonderful lattices that answer different similar-sounding questions about graph theory. And so it will actually shed light on the fundamental mathematical nature of a jammed system if we can answer this question in 3D. So we're really happy that we're going to be able to do that. The last result, I don't think I'm going to show you really, really what it is in the interest of time, but I'll talk around it. Since jamming is a phase transition, what generic features of phase transitions, in particular critical exponents, do fixed particles allow us to calculate? So if you've had a statistical physics course or if you've taught one, you know what I mean by critical exponents. If not, again, this is a good time to check for your messages on your cell phone. I'll just talk around it just a little bit. We're writing a preprint called Pinning Susceptibility, the Effect of Dilute Quench Disorder on Jamming. And I'll flip real quickly through the couple of slides that mention it. Dilute, that means we only have a couple of obstacles. Boring, you know. Well, two, what can two possibly do to a huge system? Some of the systems Samer has run have 4,000 blue particles in them and two fixed particles. Well, remarkably, the point of phase transition is a very delicate point where even putting in two fixed particles can get its message across the system. And so it actually has some sense, and those statistical physics mavens in the audience maybe will feel okay if I say there's an analogy to something like the Ising model. There's a lattice of spins, there's a magnetization, and when you differentiate it, you get this peak called the susceptibility. It's how susceptible the system is to saying, okay, I'll magnetize this way, okay, I'll magnetize the other way. In an external field, Bob Griffiths and then Peter Reynolds and then Lincoln Chase and Andrea Liu got this cool idea that you could use this ghost spins to get its susceptibility. And so what we have is these pins acting kind of like ghosts, kind of like our little decoys in the system. And if you look at the probability of jamming, and then you take the derivative with respect to the density of pins, damn if you don't actually get a peak which corresponds to a susceptibility, if you will. So we call it the pinning susceptibility, and the codes that are running now that Samer is shepherding through the queue are hard at work finding this critical exponent. So in the limit of an infinite system, this should go to infinity, and this number says how fast it goes to infinity. Right now we're getting, did I get it right, Samer, 1.2? Cool. Okay, so we're getting 1.2 in two dimensions. We're getting it for two different kinds of potential, so it doesn't seem to care what kind of interaction the spheres have. The big question, does it care whether it's 2 or 3D? And for people who know about this, I'll just say three words: upper critical dimension. So that's enough of that. In the last, 15 minutes, I'll try and take less that are allotted to me. I want to switch topics and talk about dynamics rather than statics and say, suppose we want to simulate people or particles and we care about their dynamics. Are they jammed at a certain density or rate of entry? And really, when you want to talk about people that get stuck because no one can get out that door, it's more appropriate to say, are they pinned or is it a situation of clogging rather than jamming? People argue about this. What's their flow rate? What emergent behaviors exist? Do you remember those lanes that you saw in the video? Is there herding behavior? External forces, role of obstacles or attractions? So all of these are features that you might want to know about if you're thinking about the dynamics. So pedestrians or particles, which ones are you going to simulate? I don't want to paint with too broad a brush. I'll say that these two different realms have a lot in common, though they have very crucial differences, and you have to be sensitive to it. Pedestrians or little plastic spheres. You care about the flux of these as a function of the corridor width for both systems. You care about the density and the geometry and how they affect the flux. You see similar arching going on. So when there is a jam, there tends to be a little structural arch there that our engineering colleagues would recognize as something that supports itself. And unfortunately, it supports itself and it keeps everybody else from coming through the doorway. Yet, you have to admit that with people, there's a motivation which isn't just, ooh, gravity's pulling on me. There's a more complicated motivation. There might be stimuli that have a psychological component, and they result in a behavioral reaction that might be quite personal. And also, I don't think there's an analog, at least not in the granular material field, to injury. We don't really care about injury. These are tough little things. We care maybe about global fracture and flowing, but we don't really care about each little thing being harmed. Yet, there is a claim that there are two kinds of situations. And one kind is a simple or standard situation, like people are leaving a lecture hall that they leave all the time in a building that they know very well. And in a standard situation, reactions are automatic and characterizable, and you can use what's called the social force model. So Helbing and Molnar take this point of view. Others take this point of view. And if you want to simulate, you could do it based on forces, whether it's people or whether it's little granular things. Or you could do a rules-based simulation, and that's more, I think, people in the artificial intelligence community are more at home with those kinds of simulations, rules-based, agent-based simulations. I'd like to show you an example from outside, an example from inside of Swarthmore. Here's a classic rules-based simulation of a system. These are Android birds. They're called Boids. Craig Reynolds came up with them in 1986. And as these Boids fly around, what I hope you'll keep in mind is that there are only three rules dictating what they're doing, and every Boid has the same three rules in mind. One is cohesion. No Boid wants to get too far from the center of mass of the other Boids. The other is, repulsion. You don't want to hurt your wings, so you don't want to bump into another Boid. And then another one is alignment. You want to go the general direction that the flock is going. So every Boid is looking or sensing, and somehow the Boids around it, they take the average velocity vector and they say, I want to go in that direction. So whether it's a really simple project that a student did for a programming course in MATLAB, or whether it's a really amazingly rendered flock of Boids, or whether you're watching the movie The Mummy and seeing all these little antlers, these insects scuttling around, or whether your kid or you are playing on the PlayStation and seeing lots of beings doing things. Typically, if you see lots of beings doing something, no animator worked to make each of them make a lot of autonomous decisions. Every one of them is following the same set of rules, and it's a tiny set of rules in this case, in the canonical case. Only three rules give you extremely complicated motions. So that's pretty beautiful, and here I have an example of something that's a little more pared down. It's our easy Java simulation of people exiting a room. The student who worked on this was Mariam van der Heide. Mariam did this when she was just a rising sophomore. She just graduated last fall. So I'll set this going. And what you'll see is that we're going to set the density of people in this room to 40%, and we're going to let them try and get out this door. And they'll try and get out this door. Six people, seven, eight, nine have exited. That's the green line. A few people are hurt, so the blue squares turn black when people get hurt. It's all fun and games till someone gets hurt. She's increasing the density now, or I am, actually. And a lot more people are getting hurt. And you can see certain realistic features, like the waves of hurt actually travel backward. Like there will be a compressional wave that will travel backward through the crowd of people. And this is the kind of the motivational part. People want to go through the door. So these arrows show which way people want to go if they're occupying a certain square. And they want to go with more enthusiasm the more the arrows are blue and the less that they're red. So that's our rules-based simulation. There are also force-based simulations. So let me just give you a feeling for why they're different, how they are different. The particles feel forces. They feel forces from the other particles, and they feel forces from the environmental features. And then they do, you know, force equals mass times acceleration. They move in response to the forces. However, if you're not talking about inert matter, like grains of sand, if you're talking about animals, you include forces like desire and the social forces. So just additional forces to put into your calculation. Here's a nice schematic that I took from someone named Mehran, who's in a computer vision lab in Florida, that this particle person would really like to move toward this goal. However, this person's actual velocity is pointing this way because this person is feeling certain interaction forces from other people. This person, that avoidance rule, doesn't really want to walk into this person. What's mind-blowing to a physicist is that we call these forces, okay, they're repulsive and attractive, fine. They're time and velocity dependent. Physicists don't usually deal with forces that are time dependent, but if I see a store window and I'm really attracted to what's in there and I want to go look at it, I'm not going to look at it forever. I'm going to eventually be like, enough, you know, and I'm going to walk away. So there is a time dependence to the forces. And also, they don't obey Newton's third law. Just because I am walking towards someone and move back, I don't want to bump into them. They don't even see me. They don't have eyes in the back of their head. So there is no conservation of momentum. There's no Newton's third law thing going on with these forces. Here, I have two simulations to show you. It's the last thing I want to show you before I sum up. Force-based simulations, we wrote them in this environment, Easy Java Simulations by Paco Escobar and Wolfgang Christian. And here are the two students, Fai and Travis, who did an amazing job on these. I really like this one. It doesn't produce any result. Well, there might be one novel thing about it. We have two teams. The blue team would really like to get to a goal up here at the top, and the red team would really like to get to a goal down here at the bottom. So here they go. Yay. Scrimmage. And what you see is, you really shouldn't call it lane formation, but what there is one team will break through the line of the other, and then the other will break through the first, and people call that oscillations at bottlenecks. So there'll be an oscillatory behavior back and forth. Okay, so here we see, yeah, there's the oscillation. First blue, then red. And this is just a bunch of different trials where we just run it repeatedly. The last, okay, bonk, all right, everybody got where they're going. The last trial I put in here because everybody doesn't get where they're going. And that's something kind of new. Go. Okay. So, I don't know. We've got to give it a name and get some grant money for it. Oh, no. Hey, little help. So I would call that dynamical trapping, and that's something I've never read about, but for a certain velocity of particles, for certain types of interactions, you would actually get some particles trapped forever on the wrong side. So that's an answer searching for a question, and maybe that's something that we can explore in the future. And the last simulation I want to show you is a really multi-purpose one. We can watch the number of particles exited and monitor their energy. We can put on gravity, which means that they're inert particles. Or we can have them be people. We can have them be pedestrians. Monodisperses, are they the same size? Blockade, you'll see in Sight the Exit, is can they see where they're going, or is it smoke-filled? And when I turn on Sight the Exit, the ones that can't see the exit don't know where to go. And actually, in this version of the simulation, they don't wander at random. They just respond to kind of inertial forces. So let's just let this go, and I just want folks to see the different features that you can build into one simulation. So off they go under gravity. We're losing a lot, so we replace the ones we've lost. In at the top, the color corresponds to the velocity of the particles. Okay, now they're pedestrians. You don't really see too much difference, but Sight Exit, now these guys are lost. They're heading all in the wrong direction because they've just suffered an impulsive collision, and the ones near the exit know what to do. They're trying to go for the exit, and so one can monitor how many folks get out as a function of the different situations. What am I doing here? Oh, I'm going to make two doors. So the question is two doors better than one? Let's say they both have the same width. No, because you can get transient arching. Well, if they're too narrow, you can get arching. But an outstanding question that hasn't been answered generally is, under what situations is it better to take one wide door and make it two separate doors? And the answer clearly depends on kind of the rules and the system you're simulating. This is a blockade, and we can move it around. And we almost had a great idea here. We did, but we got scooped in 2011 by another group. So I think I'll just stop the simulation there and show you the next slide, which is that you can actually enhance flow with a strategically placed blockade with a strategic geometry. So here we have no blockade, and then we have one that's sufficiently small that stuff can flow to either side. And you turn kind of chaotic flow, where the particles are bumping off each other and getting in each other's way, to more smooth layer-like laminar flow. So the flow rate actually increases. Then if you make this is called the waiting room effect. I guess everyone's all blocked up here waiting to see the doctor in the... And then underneath here, there's a big vacuum. And here the obstacle has gotten so big that we've got bridging and blocking that comes from the obstacle itself. So it's kind of delicate to find the right size obstacle to make that happen. We have seen it. So in conclusion, I hope some of the things you'll take away from this talk, I hope you'll take some of these things away from the talk. This is too long a list. Jamming applies both to animals and to inert things. Jamming can be frustrating or even lethal, or it can be beneficial. It is understandable from the point of view of statistical physics. We can simulate jamming via rules-based or force-based methods. We can look at the static properties. We can inquire about the dynamical properties. And at Swarthmore, in collaboration with Penn, we've done C++ simulations with fixed obstacles to show how point J moves when you change the density, what obstacle geometries actually help jamming. Are there new critical exponents? Yes, there are, associated with a jamming transition. There's lots of work that we can do in the near future. We need to vary the obstacle densities, and I assume that when the obstacles are really packed in, we're going to see some really new kinds of configurations. It's going to be a qualitatively different picture of what it means to be jammed when the obstacles are quite thickly placed in the system. 3D systems are important. Looking at mechanical properties are important. And finally, that we've done EJS, Easy Java Simulations. They're good. They can switch between dynamics of particles and people. They're really easy to use and modify. One can give them to a student who hasn't had a computer science course yet, and they can be doing authentic science in a very brief time. But things have gotten so sophisticated in the computer science community, with such beautiful simulations that are optimized with mind-blowing graphics, that pedestrian safety codes are very high level out there in the big world. And so our simple codes are still awaiting a novel problem that we can solve and write about. So I would like to thank everybody, my colleagues at Penn, the Lou and Durian groups, the Swarthmore students who've worked on this project. I have the most supportive department, just the most collegial people. I thank the Department of Physics and Astronomy for being the wonderful people you are. I thank my supportive family, LG, and the people who provided the money, Petroleum Research Fund, the National Science Foundation, the Division of Natural Sciences, Jean Lang, who gave a grant for sabbatical. And thank you for listening.